So we're going to shift focus here a little bit now, and our next speaker is Dr. Glenn Levine. Dr. Levine is not a pediatric surgeon. He is a rural surgeon in Oregon, and he's been very active in the American College of Surgeons working with our rural surgery group. So, Dr. Levine.
Thank you to those who stayed and didn't hit the doors when we had the technical glitch. I entitled this talk, Pediatric Appendicitis in a Critical Access Hospital, Balancing Resources, Expectations, and Expertise. It is my assumption that very few of you work in critical access hospitals. I'm going to spend some time trying to explain something about the milieu in which I've operated for almost the last generation. But our resources are really limited. We have limited human resources, we have limited physical resources, and sometimes we have limited depth in both of those categories. So if somebody goes out sick or we lose one piece of equipment, we're kind of out of business. I'm certain that's not the case in the tertiary hospitals and the children's hospitals that most of you work in. Nevertheless, our patients' expectations are that we send healthy children home. And to do that, you have to look at both your own expertise as the surgeon and the total expertise that's there for your care team. There's a lot of different factors that really come to play when you decide whether or not you can proceed with appendectomy in a child. My name is Glenn Levine, and I've been a fellow of the college since the middle 90s. I work in Coquille, Oregon. Coquille is a mill town about 15 miles. For the golfers in the room, we are due east from the Pacific Dunes Golf Course. We formulate a triangle of care in Southwest Oregon with the coastal towns of Bandon and Coos Bay. Bandon also has a critical access hospital. It's a hospital where they really don't do surgery in any significant capacity. Coos Bay is more of a small community hospital. It has surgery, orthopedics. It also has specialty care such as oncology, cardiology, pulmonology. What you'll see in the photograph, the Eugene is our closest real city that probably most of you recognize by name. And Eugene is where we would send, you know, sicker children. There was pediatric surgery in Eugene. It's about 2 hours and 15 minutes by car from any of those three towns, maybe 2.5 hours from Coquille. Since everybody stayed, I'm going to give you my penultimate slide now because I know we got places to go. It is my opinion, and this is an editorial talk, that what can be done safely in most critical access hospitals in 2018 is simple laparoscopic appendectomy. I think when children present with complications, such as you've seen already today, I think when chronically ill children get routine appendicitis, or when there's a diagnostic dilemma and you cannot come to a real decision as to whether or not, you know, exactly what's going wrong with the child, then you need to get them to one of my pediatric surgery colleagues for, you know, really consummate care. What is a critical access hospital? This is a designation created by our Congress. It is bestowed by the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services on small rural hospitals, and this was created during the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. The goal is to keep small hospitals afloat financially, and they were closing in the late 80s and early 90s. There's an awful lot of history that's available to read. It was really a motivation out of the state of Montana that started this whole process and that it became nationalized. We are paid on cost-based reimbursement. We are really not paid per se on DRG numbers, so that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services will give us allowable costs per patient plus 1%. So we don't really lose money on a Medicare or Medicaid patient at the hospital level. I should mention about in fiscal year 2015, CMS paid critical access hospitals about $10 billion. It was roughly 5% of the total Medicare payouts in that year. Eligible hospitals have to meet certain characteristics. You've got to be small. Under 25 beds is what the legislation says. You have to be reasonably far from another hospital. There are exceptions. What there are no exceptions to is you must maintain an average length of stay of 86 hours. This is across all service lines. So medicine, gynecology, surgery, everybody, you take them all together, they've got to be in the hospital for a length of stay of less than 4 days. That being said, each case I sign an attestation to that I feel that this individual case will in fact be out of the hospital in 96 hours, or I will transition the patient to a swing bed, a different category of bed, or I'll transfer the patient to a bigger hospital. So there is an individual component and an average component. Critical access hospitals must maintain an emergency room that is inviolate. On the right side, this is the title page for the Balanced Budget Act in 1997. So you'll see there are 11 titles or 11 parts of this act, including stuff like Veterans Affairs, food stamps, education, and the revitalization of the District of Columbia. I will point the audience's attention to the top red circle, and that the creation of the Critical Access Hospital was one piece of a 537-page law. Despite what we learned in Schoolhouse Rock a long time ago, the process of changing a bill to a law is a very convoluted and complex process. Needless to say, the original legislation has been tweaked a time or two, most importantly by the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modification Act, which was in 2003, and that stopped the process of individual governors declaring small hospitals to be a necessary provider. And so if your critical access hospital was declared a necessary provider prior to January 1, 2006, there are a variety of different characteristics that you no longer have to meet. That being said, new hospitals are not being readily added to the rolls of the critical access hospitals. The number of critical access hospitals in the United States has been relatively stable for the last year at about 1,350. So really, what are we talking about? We love to talk about apples and oranges in surgery, but really, in this case, we're talking about apples, oranges, and steaks. The available services in a critical access hospital really widely vary depending on administrative capacity, the composition of the medical staff, what kind of expertise you have in nursing and allied health professionals. It's really a very wide swath under one name. And certainly they are way different than the hospitals most of you attend. So this is Horn Memorial Hospital in Ida Grove, Iowa. This is a less than 25-bed critical access hospital that is buoyed by four family practitioners and a group of mid-levels. They don't do surgery there, and they don't do endoscopy there. They have services like cardiac and pulmonary rehab substantially supporting an average daily census that is exceedingly low, like shockingly low for the people in this room. This is the first critical access hospital I ever attended. It is Mammoth Hospital in Mammoth Lakes, California. This is a ski town, and this is less than 25 beds. It has had critical access designation since the 1997 legislation. There are three operating rooms. There's MD anesthesia. There's a team of orthopedists. There is several general surgeons now. There is gynecologic surgeon, and you know, there's just a host of things that are done there that can't be done at a place like Horn Memorial Hospital, yet both of these places are critical access hospitals. Thankfully, the demographics of critical access hospitals are relatively the same. There's about 60 million rural Americans. They tend to be older. They have more comorbid conditions. They are less likely to be college educated. They live closer to the poverty line than their urban counterparts. And if they are not yet Medicare age, they're almost certainly to be covered by the Affordable Care Act and one of the insurance exchanges. They have less access to specialty services, obviously. Rural surgeons, about 8% of the American surgeons identify themselves as rural-based. We are older, we are mostly men, we are looking at retirement, and fully a third of critical access hospitals that have operating rooms do not have a general surgeon on their staff. So in my little place, what do I typically do? By and large, I do upper and lower endoscopy. There is no gastroenterology at any critical access hospital. We are responsible for doing this procedure. Where I am now, I probably do more upper and lower endoscopy than I do surgery. But that has not always been the case. I've had a broad-based general surgical practice at a lot of other critical access hospitals where I've done simple and complex laparoscopy. I've done thyroid and parathyroid surgery at critical access facilities. I do skin cancer work with flap reconstructions. I do a host of benign anorectal work. Abscess and soft tissue drainage is really serious. So breast and axillary cases, the three breast cancer cases I've done at Coquille Valley Hospital since I arrived there last year are the first three breast cancer cases that have been done there in about 5 years. And the aspect of my job that always freaks up my colleagues is if you come to the emergency department and you are badly injured, I am your bedside trauma receiving doctor by and large. There's simply nobody else who's ready to take care of the multiply injured patient as well as I do. So if I'm around, I basically do that work. So the large person hunched over in the spacesuit is me. We have an orthopedist. We have a very robust joint program. He was trained at the Mayo Clinic. We do anterior hip repairs and bicruciate salvage knee replacements. And when he doesn't have help, I am his help. That's something that I'm guessing very few of you participate in. I have a host of educational administrative duties, like I know you all do. In the past 2 years, I've done everything that's in the left-hand column, and my current hospital, Coquia Valley Hospital, is photographed on the right side of this slide. This structure was built in 2013 by Neenan Architecture out of Fort Collins, Colorado. They built a beautiful rural facility, and we're blessed to be able to give patients care in a place that's quite this nice. What pediatric cases have I actually done? So I've been doing this for almost 20 years. I do more appendixes than I do hernias, and I've actually done some pyloric stenosis work in the old days. I have done, unfortunately, some really horrible pediatric surgery cases on an emergency basis. I had a really sad case of a child with horrible necrotic bowel that had a radiologist standing on a barium enema bag while a bad storm blew into Mammoth. And by the time I learned about the patient, the airport was closed. And I did the case with the pediatric surgery fellow from UCLA on the intercom telling me what to do. If you are in fact still in this audience, sir, thank you very much. This is my most recent pediatric appendix patient. This was taken last Tuesday in my office. Lacey is age 8. She was very happy to pose for this photograph, by the way. I can give you an appendicitis experience from one hospital, and this was really before I ever started keeping a case log. The four women on the right of this photograph went back and pulled our old operative log, so I did 17 pediatric appendectomies, age 4 to 13. We chose 13 because I'm Jewish, and that's the age of bar and bat mitzvah, and we figured that that's a good age to quit calling them kids. Everybody was discharged home. Some of these cases, as mentioned by a previous speaker, were done on an outpatient basis. I did have pediatricians at that time, and I had inpatient stays ranging to 5 days. Mammoth Hospital, which I left in August of 2005, is the last hospital I worked at that had pediatricians. So what regularly stops a general surgeon in a critical access hospital from performing pediatric appendectomy? There are some, and we're going to discuss this in a little bit further, who have had a limited experience doing pediatric surgery during their residency. If your first job that you take in rural America is a place that has readily accessible pediatric surgery, you're not going to do any, and after a period of time, you're pretty much going to stop taking care of children. Conversely, you can be somebody who's quite good at taking care of children, and now you move to a job where there is an existing referral pattern to pediatric surgeons, you're going to very quickly become less facile taking care of kids, and you'll really stop doing it. There are loads of concerns about anesthesia. Most of the cases we do are not with MD anesthesia. I haven't done an operation with an anesthesiologist since 2012. And so you have to work with your nurse anesthetist. Some have a real comfort level with children, and some are way more nervous, and you cannot ask them to provide anesthesia for cases when they're really not prepared. Nursing is a big concern. I can go to my med-surg unit, you know, next Monday when I'm back in Coquille, Oregon, and say, hey, we have a child to take care of, and I may be greeted with smiles and thumbs up, and everybody's interested in taking the kid, and I could do the exact same thing the following day, and if my good nurses have rotated off, I may get, you know, hangdog look from my nurses, and they're like, we really don't have anybody here who's comfortable taking care of children. So it is a day-to-day thing, and you really have to ask permission. Administrative support is vital. We just heard all about ultrasound availability. And if your administration is not going to get behind your techs and really pay them well and have ultrasound available, then you're not going to have ultrasound available. And we have lots of nights and weekends when we do not have ultrasound in my small hospital. And there are lots of small critical access hospitals that simply do not have ultrasound, period. There are malpractice and community concerns. I mean, we work in a very, very small place. If you put a bad outcome into town, it is not well received. If that bad outcome happens to be a child, you may in fact be putting yourself out of business. So there are real community concerns about taking care of children in small rural places. I'm going to release some data that's non-published. Dr. Mary Fallick graciously allowed me to take some of this data. She is the Director of Pediatric Surgery at the University of Louisville. She used an online tool to survey self-identified rural surgeons. She got less than 100 respondents from an online tool that's regularly visited by 650 rural surgeons, and we were a little bit disappointed that more people didn't take the time to fill out the survey. 40% of the people recognize that they spent 3 months or less on a pediatric surgical service total during their residency. The strong majority of the people who responded felt like they spent enough time on pediatric surgery and that the time spent was both useful and valuable still in their clinical career. 90% of the people responded either said they were extremely or very comfortable doing pediatric appendectomy. The key is to understand that this question was phrased exclusive of newborns. So you're saying 10% of people, general surgeons working in rural America, are still not comfortable taking care of pediatric appendectomy patients, which I thought was a little bit interesting. She asked about numerous other individual procedures, and the only other things that even got close to appendectomy in terms of comfort were umbilical and inguinal hernia repair. The people who were really extremely comfortable performing pediatric surgery did identify some barriers. Largely, they were administrative and support, particularly ultrasound, and the fact that we simply don't have pediatricians in critical access hospitals any longer. 40% of respondents stated they had firm absolute age limits for doing a case, which is, I thought, a little unusual. I've never really thought about it quite in that context. The nuts and bolts of what goes on when I see a child who has abdominal pain or may have imaging consistent with appendicitis is I will send a text or an email to my pediatric surgeon in Eugene, Dr. Kim Rusher. She has been exceedingly supportive of my practice of taking care of children in rural America. And so I'll let Kim know I've got a child. Kim may ask me some questions. She may ask me to look at an image, or she may tell me, oh, Glenn, do this case. You've got this. When I was formulating this talk, I asked Kim, besides me, how else do you get your cases? How do the other rural surgeons in the state send patients to you? And she said the number one way this happens is that simply there is no ultrasound available. The ER doctor decides that they are not going to perform CT imaging as frontline diagnostics for a child, and they send the patient with undiagnosed appendicitis, with just a diagnosis of abdominal pain, to Eugene to get an ultrasound done. So the local general surgeon never even realizes that the patient was there, and obviously this case migrates out. And I lost a case, at least one like this, from Coquille since January 2nd of this year. We're not the only surgeons, the rural surgeons, who are interested in doing appendectomy. You may have seen this under the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery, but there are trauma surgeons who are really interested in getting into the pediatric appendectomy game. The details of this study, this was from a level one trauma hospital in Evanston, Illinois. It was retrospective. They used the ages of 5 to 10, not Jewish authors probably, 220 children, and they only had minimal outcomes between the cases that were done by the trauma surgeons, the pediatric surgeons. They were willing to admit that since it was a decade-long retrospective study, it was the pediatric surgeons doing the lion's share of the work closer to 10 years ago, and the trauma and acute care surgeons took over in the last couple of years, and perhaps they did benefit by advances in minimally invasive technology. Can this study be repeated in a critical access hospital? Well, truthfully, probably not. We'd never have a matching group of pediatric surgeons. If volume was a problem in a level one trauma hospital, it might be an insurmountable problem in critical access hospitals. It is possible with rural leadership that now exists within the College of Surgeons and online communication that we could come up with something that would be cogent, and that remains to be seen. Again, my next to last slide, nothing's really changed. I think if you man or woman a critical access hospital and you are by yourself without pediatricians and working with a CRNA and not MD anesthesia, you have to be very careful about what children you operate on. And you have to have ready communication with your pediatric surgeon to get these children to an appropriate level of care. I would be remiss if I did a talk on any aspects of pediatric or surgery and not thank Randy Powell, who passed away a couple of years ago. I did 2 3-month rotations at the University of South Alabama on pediatric surgery, and Dr. Powell chiefed both my PGY2 and PGY4 years. I did some surgery on the weekends with Max Ramanowski, who was also a pediatric surgeon at the University of South Alabama, and I still have the marks to prove that I was working with Dr. Ramanowski. Yeah. But it was really Dr. Powell who taught me the lion's share of everything I know. He was an AOA electee. He was a brilliant guy, consummate knowledge of surgical history and technique. A lot of what I teach medical students today about functionally doing surgery, I learned from Dr. Powell, how to hold instruments, how to get a case done. And I miss him a lot, so I wanted to put his picture up. Thank you for your kind attention.